industrial accidents,
ancient
solving
poisoners,
crime,
poison
chemical
prevention.
Spills. This is Toxic History.
Pharmacist Varun Vora is a clinical toxicology consultant and senior director with the Michigan Poison and Drug Information Center and associate professor at the Wayne State University School of Medicine in Detroit, Michigan.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk about the L'Affaire Lafarge, or the Lafarge Affair, and a glimpse into forensic toxicology's first brush in the spotlight. I have no disclosures. The objectives are to understand the role of arsenic as both a substance of legitimate use and as a poison in the 19th century, describe an infamous alleged homicidal poisoning involving arsenic and the subsequent role of forensic toxicology, to describe the origins and principles of the Marsh test for arsenic detection, and to understand the early limitations and controversies surrounding arsenic detection methods in medical legal settings. So I'm going to take you back to the 1800s in France, 1840 to be exact, in the throes of a criminal trial that has the entire country's attention. The accused, a dark-haired, sophisticated Parisian named Mary Lafarge. Her alleged crime, murder by arsenic. This trial was famous or infamous for several reasons, because of the background of the accused and for being a landmark case in demonstrating the real-world application of forensic toxicology in real time. But how did we get here? First, let's talk about arsenic and its place in the 19th century. It garnered a notorious reputation and was often associated with suspected poisonings. Arsenic could odorlessly be dissolved in foods and drinks. It had multiple legitimate and common uses as a rodenticide in agriculture and dyes and pigments and even cosmetics. And it was widely available in apothecaries. But there's something else that was uniquely unsettling about arsenic in those days, especially among the bourgeois salon class, in other words, the upper middle class and aristocracy, who were synonymous with culture and etiquette. Even though arsenic was widely available, it was typically limited to sale to well-known people, which means it was not sold to indigents, prostitutes, beggars, and the visibly destitute. So arsenic was often being used as a poison for murder by the type of person that society at large would not view as a murderer. This helps at least in part contextualize arsenic's monikers as the inheritance powder or the king of poisons. Marie Lafarge was born Marie Capelle in upper-class privilege, with her extended family tree including diplomats, barons, secretary generals, and decorated military officers. So you could say Marie was on track to leading a safe, comfortable, and wealthy life. But then came a fork in the road type moment in Marie's life. Her parents died unexpectedly within a few years of one another, and so an 18-year-old Marie was shipped off to live with one of her aunts. Marie's aunt and uncle were playing matchmaker to find Marie a husband. They eventually found a suitor, an owner of an iron forge. His name was Charles Lafarge, a 28-year-old, who apparently owned one of the finest and largest estates in Limousin. Charles lived in a grand manor called Le Glandier within a large park with spectacular views. And let's just say Charles did not make a good first impression, but still he was wealthy and could provide Marie a comfortable life. And so they were married in a small ceremony and set off back to his home. During the journey back, Marie reportedly saw a different side of Charles, a brutish and uncouth side, one with disdain for the upper social class Parisians. It didn't take long for Marie to realize he wasn't the gentleman he had portrayed. It also turned out Charles Lafarge wasn't a wealthy ironmaster. He was in significant debt and broke. His estate was falling apart, and the house itself was crumbling due to water damage, mold, and rat infestation. Marie felt deceived and now found herself stuck in a marriage, and on top of it, had in-laws who were not exactly the most welcoming and were skeptical of her privileged Parisian pedigree. Marie wrote to her friends back in Paris about her experience, about the misery and deceit that she felt. She also wrote a note to her husband pleading for release from the marriage, offering up her belongings, anything she could do to get out, even entertaining the thought of death. Unexpectedly, Charles took Marie's plea in stride and had a thoughtful response, asking her to wait before making any rash decisions. And he was apologetic for the state of the home and promised to address the repairs. So the relationship between the two apparently improved after this. Oh, and another thing, he also mentioned he unfortunately could not release her from the marriage because he really needed that dowry. Charles went to Paris for business, and Marie reportedly thinks it would be romantic to send Charles a portrait of herself along with a baked cake, and Charles receives the package and eats the cake. Not long after, Charles becomes violently ill. Physician visited him in Paris and concluded that his GI symptoms were consistent with cholera. So now when Charles eventually was well enough to return home, he'd be looked after by his mother and sister, and the family physician came by and corroborated the cholera diagnosis. Now, here's where it gets interesting. So 2 days prior, Marie had written a note to an apothecary or druggist saying, or asking for arsenic to address the rat infestation at the home. Marie was reportedly by her husband's side every day, and he complained that the noise of the rats under the floors and in the ceilings made it hard for him to sleep. Apparently, the arsenic Marie procured wasn't doing the job, so she sent for more arsenic. Try as they did, the family's care was not helping, and Charles was not improving. The whole thing didn't sit well with Charles's family, thinking that whatever Marie was feeding Charles had tiny undissolved white specks in it, claiming it was arsenic. The family physician wasn't convinced and instead said it might be parts of the ceiling plaster that were falling into the food. Charles's family still thought it was arsenic. They would boil food samples and try to see if they could smell garlic, obviously a very inexact science. Regardless, they kept Marie away from Charles and his food as much as they could. The family called another physician to get another opinion, but before he could arrive, Charles was dead. They say you poisoned him, that you put arsenic in his chicken broth, Marie was told by one of the house members that she trusted. According to Marie's memoirs, she was stunned. Yes, she did put something in his soup, but claimed it was acacia gum that she kept in a box, and she took it herself for health purposes. It was too late, though. Charles's family was convinced Marie had poisoned Charles, and the local magistrate was notified, who questioned the household and accepted samples of foods and drinks and Marie's box of powder that were to be tested. A servant came forward confessing that he buried a bag of arsenic in the garden and that he was instructed to do so by Marie. And lo and behold, the magistrate's men found a bag of powder in the garden. Local experts tried analyzing the food samples and Charles's stomach contents using older and outdated methods. They did isolate a yellow precipitate upon testing the chicken broth and in some eggnog that Charles had drank. Regardless, Marie was arrested and found herself being escorted to a Parisian prison. Now, Marie was at the gravesite of her deceased husband, and she looked like she was dressed for a funeral. Instead, she was there as part of her trial for Charles's murder. Charles's body was going to be exhumed in what would be the jumping-off point for a thrilling court case. Charles's body had decomposed extensively. His remains were described as paste instead of flesh, and scientists had to apparently scoop his remains into containers for further lab testing. The local scientists attempted to detect arsenic in Charles's body, but their methods used old-fashioned techniques. The judge wanted the latest in scientific developments to be applied. Some of the trial's greatest complications came from the local scientists' attempts to use these latest advances in forensics. This was the Marsh test, invented by the chemist John Marsh in 1836, which offered a method to detect arsenic that would unambiguously prove its existence, at least visually, in front of a jury. The judge specifically wanted the Marsh test in court for all to see, performed by professional chemists with little to no chance for technical error. The Marsh test's actual chemistry was not overly complex, but there were certain technical nuances that made it deceptively challenging. Then you have the French chemists who were reading about the Marsh test who'd never actually performed it before. So, who's the man behind the method? James Marsh was a Scottish chemist who was initially tasked with trying to detect arsenic in the case of John Bottle, who was accused of murdering his grandfather by stirring arsenic into his coffee. He tested both the coffee and the grandfather's remains using hydrogen sulfide that would produce yellow arsenia sulfide, which could be reduced into a yellow precipitate. The problem was that the test was pretty reliable with liquid, but not so with organic matter. So Marsh was able to detect arsenic in the coffee, but not the stomach contents. The coffee evidence did not translate to anything significant. The jury ruled that the suspect was innocent. Turns out years later, the suspect, John Bottle, admitted to killing his grandfather with arsenic, which didn't sit well with Marsh. So in 1836, Marsh refined his methods and created what we now know as the Marsh test. An arsenic sample would be placed in a flask with arsenic-free zinc and sulfuric acid. If the sample contained arsenic, arsine was produced, and this was then decomposed into hydrogen and arsenic, which formed a thin black metallic film on a porcelain plate. Apart from providing visual proof, the Marsh test was so sensitive that it could detect minute traces of arsenic, which would have gone unnoticed using the older testing methods. Now, the trial was dramatic to say the least and drew a lot of public media and media attention. Marie was a glamorous woman of noble birth who was raised in all the right social circles in Paris, which made her very compelling. The only pieces of evidence at that point, though, were local experts detected arsenic in the food and drink samples. Although there were signs of potential probable cause, it was all circumstantial evidence that didn't prove Marie was a murderer. Public obsession only grew as the experts started producing increasingly contradictory evidence when trying to detect arsenic in Charles's remains. Three separate groups of medical analysts gave four different reports on the evidence. The trial had other challenges, like inconclusive data from clinical symptoms and autopsy, a corpse that had long since been buried and decomposed, and the fact that historically detecting arsenic using older chemical methods had yielded equivocal results. So, regardless, the commission issued the report. Using the Marsh test, they could find no arsenic in Charles's body. Marie was vindicated. Or was she? Then came a letter to the magistrates in the trial, and this wasn't an ordinary letter. This was from Matthew Orfila, who was a renowned toxicologist and dean of the Paris Faculty of Medicine, which at the time was a powerful position that came with a lot of clout. Now, it's important to note that Orfila was very well connected with influential people, especially politicians and academics. Orfila was requested by judges quite frequently and was a founding member of the Paris Academy of Medicine. He was not convinced of the findings and questioned the local experts having produced yellow precipitate in some of the food and drink samples and claimed that the results were meaningless. Sure, the commission had used the Marsh test, but it was famously tricky, and they had done it for the very first time with no guarantee they actually performed it correctly. The prosecution was still convinced of Marie's guilt, so they wanted the test performed by Orfila. Orfila was called upon to confirm the lack of arsenic in the body and to deliver the final report. The judge ordered a second examination of Charles's remains. Now, before he offered his conclusion, Orfila gave the court some context. Now, these are Orfila's words. He determined that the human bones naturally contain trace amounts of arsenic and nowhere else in the body, and that sometimes arsenic can also be found leached from the soil, so he was extraordinarily careful in his analysis not to test bone or allow the soil to confound the results. So the second verdict was arsenic. Orfila found arsenic in Charles's remains, half a milligram, an amount so tiny it could only have ever been detected using the Marsh test. The defense scrambled and tried to call one of Orfila's rivals, Francois Rappe, to offer a counter-analysis, but he didn't make it in time before the jury reached its verdict. Orfila's testimony sealed Marie's fate, and she was found guilty of the murder and sentenced to life in prison. Now, Marie, 24 years old, would spend the next 12 years of her life in prison. She then became ill with tuberculosis and was released, only to die a few months later. Now, the Lafarge trial was a sensation in Europe, and Orfila's profile and celebrity caused international interest. Orfila's initial reception was generally positive, but his hubris and perceived overconfidence was a concern. No doubt in part due to his status and influential connections. Critics highlighted that Orfila somehow thought the appearance of the black metallic arsenic stain would be a dramatic corpus delicti akin to a smoking gun. Other experts actually found it difficult opposing Orfila, given his fame. They felt Orfila's role as a skeptic and as a critic of the initial experts in the Lafarge trial was overshadowed by his own overconfidence and his lack of acknowledgement of the limitations of his own methods. He prepared lectures and chemical analysis recreations that were delivered at amphitheaters, which were covered by the media and press and other medical journals, so he wasn't shy about showcasing his findings. His findings sparked intense debate across the medical community in Paris, but also in academic and social circles. These were known as the arsenic wars. Factions drew their lines as either pro-Lafargists or anti-Lafargists regarding the findings. The Marsh test, unfortunately, was not the panacea against the crimes of poisoning. This new method reportedly was a radiant light, but revealed a situation of, quote, total chaos, end quote. The issue was that the highly sensitive Marsh test could introduce misleading results because of a number of factors, including the chain of custody issues between the scene of the alleged crime and the lab and the courtroom, and sources of potential impurities. The chemist Francois Rappe would spend years publicly challenging Orfila, criticizing both his methods and his findings. Orfila had claimed he found a half a milligram of arsenic in Charles's body. Rappe determined the amount was actually a hundredth of a milligram. And there were a number of points in Orfila's testing where arsenic might have snuck in. For his final test, Orfila had sent one of his assistants to a neighboring town to get more reagent. That reagent was never tested for arsenic before it was used in the experiment. As for Orfila's claim that human bones naturally contain arsenic, well, it turns out they didn't. Then there was the issue of normal arsenic, meaning trace amounts of arsenic that are present in the human body from the environment, like water and food, which could be detected with the Marsh test. But how were experts to distinguish between normal arsenic and the amounts of arsenic that can constitute a poisoning? Rappe pointed out that there were countless sources of contamination that could explain the presence of arsenic in corpses without implying a poisoning crime. Subsequent experiments refined the chemical testing, which raised questions and doubts about how the results were to be interpreted. What this boiled down to were forensic experts who were dismayed by the fact that the questions and controversies that arose from the highly sensitive Marsh test put the science of forensic toxicology in the crosshairs and sowed doubt among the public, who questioned the reliability of the experts and the interpretations of their findings. 2 years after the Mary Lafarge was found guilty, another woman, Madame Lacoste, was accused of murder by arsenic. The Lafarge case was the closest point of comparison, and the court invited chemist Monsieur Chevalier to testify. Chevalier was asked whether the amount of arsenic found was close to the amount that served as grounds for conviction in the Lafarge case. Chevalier said he could not reply because the amount was so minute as to preclude an effective comparison. The jury was dumbfounded. They declared Madame Lacoste innocent. Marie Lafarge heard about the news of Madame Lacoste's exoneration while she was in prison and apparently remarked, quote, "My ghost saved her," end quote. Now, the questions and controversies surrounding Orfila's findings and his experimental methods in general would follow him for the rest of his career. There were questions about the credibility of his methods and the interpretations using the highly sensitive chemical tests, which eventually led him to rarely accept court requests in the final decade of his career. He eventually realized that the sensitivity of the Marsh test was a double-edged sword. It could detect very small quantities of arsenic that could provide convincing visual evidence, but defense teams could also argue about the sources of potential impurities or ask about whether it was part of trace amounts of arsenic found in human bodies from the environment, which could create doubt in juries. Then take into account how widespread arsenic was for various uses at the time, which added another layer of complexity. Regardless, his contribution still had long-lasting effects. His research still had merit and was far from being junk science in the courtrooms. His methods wouldn't provide definitively reliable tools for putting prisoners away, but his work spurred new chemical testing. These newer tests introduced more challenges and unexpected questions, and of course raised doubts about the utility of these newer testing methods and reliability of the expert reports, especially when a guilty verdict could mean the death penalty. But these events also encouraged more research that eventually produced more reliable chemical testing, and this led to more sophisticated technologies for poison detection and criminal investigations, more data and more conclusions about the absorption and effects of poisons, and also expanded the focus to appropriate chains of custody, mitigating impurities, and increasing the amount of experts that could perform high sensitivity testing in reliable ways. Now, whether or not Marie Lafarge actually was guilty of murdering her husband, or whether or not Charles Lafarge was even poisoned with arsenic, are likely to stay controversial with no definitive consensus. Regardless, the Lafarge affair was the first prominent trial that applied forensic toxicology principles that electrified a nation and had people talking internationally. The science of modern forensic toxicology was being revealed on a grand stage in real time. The Marsh test raised expectations concerning the role of science in criminal investigations, but in turn produced more questions and controversy, with many questioning forensic testing results. Debates would continue throughout the latter part of the 19th century because of the concepts like impurities from reagents, graveyard soil, and the debates about normal arsenic. What the Marsh test did do, though, was provide the courts with a new form of material evidence, the black arsenic-like stains, which, according to some like Orfila, spoke for themselves, while others debated were not mediated by expert interpretation. These experts called for a return to more traditional sources of toxicological knowledge, like clinical observations, and looking for consistencies with anatomical and pathological data. The Lafarge trial and its unanticipated consequences helped shape the development and activities of forensic toxicology. The Marsh test would become the chief terror of poisoners as the public trials and method gained public interest and served as a platform for more refined and sophisticated techniques. These would uncover crimes that previously would have gone undetected, and eventually led to a significant decline in the use of arsenic for murder. The king of poisons, while not necessarily dead, had lost its crown. These are my references. Thank you for listening.